Hi, Haley.
Hello.
You know, long ago I was asked if I'd consider having a guest who was a sci-fi writer or any other genre if the story was also a mystery. And my response was, of course. This actually was another podcaster, I believe, that asked me this question. My first thought was like Gattaca, which is a fine mystery. Deja Vu with Denzel, I think it's a great time travel novel. Had poor reviews. I think it's underrated. Soylent Green is another. We've had some paranormal books, but other than that, no one has taken me up and going deeper into any other genres with crime fiction in it. Are you going to make me a man of my word today?
I can't promise sci-fi, but yeah, on the other hand, I think so.
Yeah, what's just sci-fi? Just any other type of genre. Awesome. Well, let's chat about that, because you've got a pair of detectives searching for a serial killer while dealing with monsters. You have my attention right after this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. I'm Brad, and with me is Haley Piper. Hello again, Haley.
Hello.
Are you at home with your wife in Maryland?
Yeah, I am.
Good. I'm glad you're comfortable. I want to quickly get into Haley's novel, No Gods for Drowning, which comes out in about 3 weeks from now, but it is available for pre-order as we speak. The concept of the novel is fun to me. In the midst of terrified gods of what's coming and a monster threatening to destroy the city of Valentine, we have two men with ace investigations tracking a serial killer. Now, Haley, it sounds like bad times in Valentine City.
Yes.
All right. Before we start getting deeper in the story, I'd like to tell people more about you. And if you're not familiar with the horror genre, I'll tell you, Haley Piper is a pretty big deal. She's won many awards, including the Bram Stoker Award for Superior Achievement for a first novel. She's won additional awards from Ladies of Horror and Fiction and the Lesfic Award for Best Fiction. She's published six. This will be her seventh novel, and there are more on the way. And she has a list of short stories and flash fiction that is more than I can count. So let's get right to No Gods for Drowning. The blurb alone tells you there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
But the listener will tell you the blurbs are not enough for me. I have what I call beyond the blurb. So obviously you can't tell the whole story. We don't even want you to. But tell us as much as you can that you really whet our appetites.
So this, as you can probably tell from the blurb, this does not take place in our world. It is a kind of dark fantasy world by way of a noir detective story, as opposed to, I think when you hear fantasy, typically people think like medieval knights and dragons and such. And in this case, it's these detectives trying to hunt down a serial killer in a world where their gods have disappeared, essentially. And the gods used to protect mankind from sea monsters and essentially carnivorous mermaids called glories. And they're not there anymore to do that. So it's been about 10 years since the gods vanished. And a serial killer seems to be sacrificing people to try to bring one of the gods back.
Well, at least they have good intentions. Now, these gods, are they similar to like the Greek gods, or they interacted with the humans?
Yeah, it used to be that there was a god per town or city. Some of them were nomads or wanderers, but people were pretty dependent on them. And now they're just up and gone. No explanation. They just started to trickle away. And now they live in other countries, other lands of this world. And nobody can get to them because of said glories and sea monsters wreck any ship that tries to cross the sea. And the tech level of this world is pretty like what you'd associate with like 30s, 40s. Like they have guns, they have cars, but they don't fly yet. They don't, they're developing still with a lot of stuff. So there's not really a way to get away.
So early technology.
Yeah. Early 19th century or 20th century. I always get that mixed up.
No, I do too. So the investigators with Ace Investigations is Alex and Cecil. Can you tell us more about them?
Yeah, Alex is much more the kind of like hard-laced of the group. He used to work for the police of this other city before he was just disgusted with all of that and walked away from it and started working privately, mostly to help kind of people dealing with personal problems. And Cecil is his partner, who used to be a therapist, actually, because he has some clairvoyance abilities since he's a descendant from one of the gods. So they kind of partnered up after a time and started going to business together. And now that things have gotten kind of dire in this place, they can't really just, how would I say it? They can't do the kinds of jobs they used to do. And they end up getting hired to try to find this murderer.
So it sounds like he's like a demagogue.
Yeah, they don't call them that in this, but yeah, it is that kind of thing. It's, I think they probably don't call them that because it's pretty weak. Mm-hmm. Their abilities aren't reliable, and it gets worse because he's kind of a drunk.
Yeah, that never makes anything easy. Well, that's for the drunk, but nobody else.
Right, exactly.
But I would think that the clairvoyance would help him.
It does. It does somewhat. There's even a conversation about getting towards the middle of the book where Cecil asks Alex if he ever kind of wanted his clairvoyance abilities. And Alex is like, it might make things easier, but wouldn't make me better at what I do.
This is a show about mystery, and that's why Haley is here. But we're going to talk a lot about horror today because I don't read enough of it, and I'm fascinated by the genre. And quite honestly, the more I've learned about Haley, I'm fascinated about her as well. So we're going to go down that route quite a bit today. Start off, Haley. When you were a kid, what scared you?
Well, the dark.
Monsters under the bed or in the closet?
A little bit. The dark kind of was always just like, it wasn't like I thought, oh, they're going to come from under the bed or the closet. It was kind of like, if it's dark, they can come from anywhere. It's not like you can see. So that scared me. Also, Chucky. Anytime the commercials were on, that scared me. Yeah.
Chucky was scary as hell. What scares you now?
Oh, many things. I mean, I think if you look on the news, you can see some of them. Just the kind of existential situations we're in right now with the world and disease and the current cultural climate that seems to be spreading in like a disease in the United States and other places.
So the things so many of us are scared of right now, of what we're seeing.
I can't say they're original. It's not like I'm scared of flying spider bats or something.
That's quite all right. I'm scared death of lightning, so I always know the next bolt is going to strike me dead. If I'm outside, I'm okay inside. From roller coasters to spiders to horror novels, why do we like to be scared?
I think it's less just being scared generally so much as having a fear we can control. I mean, there's so many things that are scary that are completely outside of our ability to influence. Whereas watching a horror movie or going on a roller coaster, going to a Halloween haunted house, any of those things, you can stop it when you want to, pretty much, or it's your option to go experience it. I think we do like the thrill, but that thrill can end. You can always close a book. You can always decide, I'm not going to ride that ride again, et cetera. And I think it helps. That's not really what you asked, but I think it helps us a little bit process some of the things that we are afraid of that we can't control. Like, to me, horror is healing. It helps process a lot of the stuff that we experience.
Yeah, because you said you can stop it at any time, but we willingly go to it. We'll see a scary film, and then we'll go right back in and be almost just as scared again.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of it. You decide to do that. At each step, you choose to do that. And sometimes it's a matter of psyching yourself up. Like, I remember when I was little, I watched the 1988 remake of The Blob up to a point where it terrified me so much that I had to turn it off. But I got that far, and I did go back to it later, and, it still scares me, but I love it, and I willingly watch it. But I built myself up to the point where I could do that.
So you personally, why do you feel you are so immersed in the horror genre?
I mean, it's that stuff that I was just talking about. I also just like it. I've always been attracted to, dark fiction, monsters, creepy ideas, things like that. Sometimes it's the subtlety of gothic horror. Sometimes it's the awe and imagination of cosmic horror and all the things in between.
I'm going to go back to The Blob because I love the original the original Blob with Steve McQueen.
I like that one too. I like that one too.
As a kid, that scared the shit out of me, and I watched it over and over and over again. I had problems with the newer one. It had some scary things, but I don't know if I should spoil it. Yeah, I'm going to spoil it for people. Matt Dillon's younger brother, I can't remember his name. Do you remember when he was sitting in the car?
Oh, no, I know the scene you're talking about. I just mean that movie just disturbs me so much. Like, because with FD's Blob, I watched it over and over too, but it never scared me.
Uh-huh.
I did like it a lot, though. The 80s one, just you see so much.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more
and
gory.
It bothers me. Yeah, it bothers me, but I still willingly watch it, like you said.
Did you ever watch Son of the Blob?
No.
Don't.
I could never find a copy.
Don't. It's boring. It's really boring. The only interesting thing is the woman that played, I can't think of her name, the one that played Shirley on Laverne and Shirley is in it playing a hippie. But that's about the only thing I found interesting in that one. So No Gods for Drowning has a very interesting twist. And normally I don't ask people where their ideas come from because, as you know, as an author, sometimes we just don't know. I'm going to break my rule today. How did you come across the idea to slide one genre, the crime genre, in with one you traditionally write, which is the horror genre?
So funny enough with this, I think some of it started with the dark fantasy elements, kind of the gods aspect. And then the crime element came next because I had tried to start writing it and it was coming up too much like Lord of the Rings kind of setting. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I don't want to do that. And years passed before I was like, well, why don't you just set it in something that you do find interesting, which was kind of this more like early 1900s, or that sounds too far back, but you know what I mean? Like, you know, kind of like with all the noir tropes that I enjoyed, like, you know, the detectives and trench coats and like all that stuff. Like, you can give me the most like basic trope heavy noir. And I'm just like, I eat that up. I love it. But so I was just like, I'm just going to do stuff with that and following that kind of setting and stuff. The horror came in just kind of because I don't think I can escape it when I write. So I started off trying to do, you know, what I've described. And it's just the moment you get to the house when she's murdering these guys to sacrifice them to her god, it was just like, this is horror too. I can't get away from it. And so there's horror laced through the entire book because it is about this woman who's killing these people and is about these monsters coming up out of the sea. And it is about the idea of being abandoned by everything you depended on and then trying to bring that back and considering that it may be worse than you remember or that you never really understood it in the first place.
You spoke of tropes. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of tropes in mystery. And probably the one that most people know of is the down on his luck, drunken PI with the dame at the desk. What are some of the common tropes in horror and which ones do you think it's time for people to stop?
I don't think it's time for people to stop any of them. Mm-hmm. It depends on the subgenre, really. You could say it's time for zombies to stop running. Or that it's time for vampires to stop, I don't know, being from Eastern Europe. I mean, there's definitely stuff that should be moved away from, I think, as far as depictions. Certain things you'd see in like Dress to Kill or Silence of the Lambs, where it's like transphobic stuff or racist stuff. Like things like that, I don't think that there's any purpose in continue to perpetuate the bigotry. That said, depending on the voice telling it, you can explore what that effect, the effect of that stuff has on you, as we see with a lot of recent horror, thankfully. I think it's always been there, but it's getting a lot more amplification now. I'm steering way off of your question, but like, I mean, yeah, it's depending on the slashers. You could say it's time to chuck the final girl. Cosmic horror, let's do things that have nothing to do with Lovecraft. There's so many. For as many tropes as there are, though, there's like 10 people who can do something that you've never seen before with it.
Like I said, with the drunken down and out PI, it's been done 1,000 times, but a good writer can take that same trope and still make it interesting.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. I don't think they ever really die.
And that's kind of Cecil in this, is like, yeah, he's drunk and he's not where he wants to be with his life, but he's also got a really good sense of humor. He's not a grouch. He's the kind of the lightness, you know, when characters are talking to him.
Well, you brought up LGBTQ. In queer mystery, we actually had an era where it looked like it was looking good for us.
Yeah.
And then that kind of went away. What about in the horror genre? Is there enough queer representation there?
I don't think there's ever like enough, because there isn't really a bar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like I think enough gets in place because of movie producers, publishers and such they're like, all right, well, we need 6 of these to be in the clear, like have as armor against criticism.
You make a good point. We have a friend of mine who's on the show quite often. She's transgender, and she has more than once been told, oh, we already published a transgender mystery this year.
Right.
You know, so that was a bad choice of words on my part.
I wasn't getting on you. I was just exploring the question.
I didn't take it personally. It's the way I worded it. But still, is it harder to get a queer horror novel written?
I think right now is a good time for that stuff. I'm in a position where I don't have to struggle as much with that as some people might. But when I started, yeah, it made me nervous. I wasn't sure if like people were going to be interested in that. I didn't know what the climate was. And I kind of kept it toned down a bit. Like, so there was only like a reference here to a character having a same-sex partner or even being interested in people. As it's gone on, I've gotten more explicit with it. And I've said like on Twitter before, like, I'm not going to not do it. Like, I'm not going to not have my queer, I'm not going to get rid of my queer characters. I'm not going to have it where an editor is just like, you know, we could sell this better if you didn't queer it up so much. And I'm just like, well, you got the wrong writer then. Like, I stand by my principles of this, regardless of the consequence.
You're popular on Twitter. You have about 10,000 followers. You have over 10,000 followers. But your profile says, make horror gay as fuck. Except you're very nice and you do AF. Like, we don't know what that means.
You only get so many characters, too.
Yeah, exactly. So make horror gay as fuck. What does that mean?
I get this question so much. I think my answer is never consistent. It was originally just to kind of encourage people, to queer folk, to write our lived situations, people like us, or themes about us. And I'm not saying that, like, you know, that hadn't been done before. And I think I've had an interviewer once try to get me in a gotcha with it, where it's like, well, you say make horror queer as fuck, but you also say horror is inherently queer. And it's like, they can both be true. Like, I can both demand that and notice and say that horror is inherently queer. I just think that you have a situation where let's say you bring out a book with queer characters, a horror book with queer characters, and somebody has an issue with that, is because they're not noticing that it's always been that way. So you do have to make demands. And I think it's right for the queer community in all genres to make those demands.
What is it about horror that makes it inherently queer?
It's kind of just always been the one that was looked at as the genre that was looked at as kind of the one that was maligned, the one that is kind of like, ugh, like that's how the reaction is with the general populace, at least until, I think horror right now is popular. There was a time in the late 90s, I think, where it was very popular. It fluctuates. There are points where it's just considered like the ugly stepchild of the, or duckling or whatever, of the horror, of the genres, the one that is like the dirty one you don't touch. And that's how queer people have been treated. And I mean, if you look at, some people say this is a stretch, but if you look at a lot of the monsters, it's really just because they're outside of society that they are monstrous. It's not because they are inherently wrong. And like, I think that queer folk, we can identify with that. I mean, if you can't, that's, you know, happy for you. But a lot of us can relate to just feeling like we don't belong.
I hate to bring it up because I can't remember the producer or director, but they were trying to do their first film and they were told by the studio, you kind of need to get your feet wet. Go do some horror films first. That's kind of what you're talking about. Do you find that offensive?
It's considered a thing that doesn't matter. I mean, there was, I forget what it was. I think it was the Chucky movies actually, where the reason they were kind of pushing, the producers were kind of pushing stuff aside back in the early 2000s was because they couldn't get rich off of a Chucky movie. And that's typically the case with a lot of horror movies. I think right now we're seeing a difference with that because you can make a horror movie for like $10 million, and then if it blows up, it makes like $90 million. But so they're game for it right now, but that's not always the case. And that's the same case with queer folk. Yeah, we have like, you know, Coca-Cola and whoever else sponsoring pride parades, but how long is that going to last with the way things are going right now politically?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Well, to kind of go in a different direction, a lot of these corporations are going, you know, playing both sides of the coin. They're
right,
they're
exactly
in the pride parade, but then they're giving money to anti-gay legislatures.
Yep.
So
yep.
I was talking to a friend the other day about, you know, boycotts. And I said, you know, sometimes you just, I mean, some companies are easy. Chick-fil-A, it's one company that owns the whole company. But others, right, major corporations, they do great things over on this side. They're listed under HRC as one of the best companies for LGBT employees. But then you turn around and you see they're doing this over there. And it,
right,
it's almost like if you wanted to boycott, you would do nothing, absolutely nothing.
Well, and that's one of those, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, but also you have to pick your battles. It's complicated.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the same time, they wouldn't have done that 30 years ago. And it does matter that they consider this to be more financially viable for them to be supportive of queer people, at least in public. Mm. As opposed to how they might have been under, you know, Reagan, for example.
Yeah, I don't want to speak on behalf of Bill Marriott, but I'm going to give you my feeling of what I think went on instead. I worked for Marriott for almost 2 decades, and it was one of the very first super gay-friendly companies. And we had diversity training before anybody even knew what it was. Bill Marriott is Mormon, and a lot of the upper executives with the corporation is Mormon. But from my experience, having met him a couple times, which was very, very brief, he is a Mormon, but he always seemed like a businessman first. And it was a good business decision. Therefore, I think it was okay and still okay to be so gay friendly. But do they really mean it? I don't know.
Who knows? Who can say with anybody, though?
Yeah, I don't want to say he doesn't, but I'm talking about corporations in general. Yeah.
Right. I mean, oh, yeah. And we shouldn't like to fall into the whole corporations as people trap, yeah, that the government set. But I just mean, like, you'll never know whether somebody means something, really, I think.
Yeah, of course. You mentioned a word earlier, and this is a question that's been on my mind. I thought, I don't know if I'll be able to get to it today. But you said the word, and I'm going to ask you right up front. Horror and slasher films. Same thing?
Yeah, slasher is a subgenre of horror.
They are? Okay. I didn't know if it was because, you know, slasher films were so popular. And since
Fine. I'm always happy to talk about horror stuff. Like, so that's, I mean, Friday 13th, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Scream, Texas Chainsaw. Like, these are all horror movies and slashers.
Well, I love the Halloween, the first Halloween, because that was really new at that time. I mean, there were others before, yeah, but that was, you know, they had like a $5 budget and made a fortune because people swamped to it.
Right.
But as a rule, I don't want to be just grossed out. I want to be scared, even if no gore ever happens.
Right.
Probably the scariest, the movies have all been terrible, but the scariest book I ever read was Amityville Horror. Now, it could be, if I read it today, I don't know if it would be as scary. I read it up in a lake in the middle of Minnesota in the dark. And it really scared me. But there's nothing gory in that novel at all.
Yeah.
I think the two can be together, but the gore just by itself, man. And that's just my opinion.
So, I mean, it's everyone. The nice thing is there's something for everyone in horror. That's how expansive it is.
Yeah. And it's very similar in mysteries.
And it's right. Exactly. Like I think most genres have it where there is a breadth of different elements.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know with a review. It helps build an audience and introduce more people to queer crime fiction. Apple and iTunes are where most people search for new shows, but if you don't use either, other apps that allow reviews include Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Spotify. Wherever you listen to podcasts, help spread the word to tune in to Queer Writers of Crime.
So speaking of mysteries, I have a lot of different authors on that write subgenres within the subgenre, which, you know, we have some that write cozy mysteries, others that write psycho serial killers, which usually a mystery writer is going to make it more of a psychological thing than just a wacky murder on the loose. In what ways do you think mystery is similar to horror, if you do?
I think just kind of it really depends on what kind of mystery, like you were mentioning, but I think atmosphere wise, I think, and it depends on the horror also, but just kind of the unknown is definitely a similar between them. And I enjoy horror mysteries. I try to write them when I can. My first book, The Possession of Natalie Glasgow, people have called a horror mystery because they are trying to figure out what is wrong with this girl. And there are a few that cross the lines between those. Legion by William Peter Blatty. Mm-hmm. I would consider both to be both a mystery book and a horror book, mm-hmm. and kind of a philosophical book. But the unknown, I think there's a slower pace also. Just there's a patient, I guess is the best word. Yeah. I guess maybe I don't have a giant list.
Well, I'm going to toss a movie out to you that it's one of my favorites. It's very scary, and my husband won't watch it. He thinks it's a brilliant film, and he said, I'll never watch it again.
I can understand that.
And that's the movie Seven.
Yeah.
Kevin Spacey's character, he did a brilliant job. We didn't really get into Kevin's head, but boy, he sure dug into Brad Pitt's head.
Right.
Would you consider that a horror film as well as a mystery film?
Yeah. And I know people who like to put things in very firm boxes, not to reference the movie itself too much.
that was a good reference.
I think people who like to put things in very firm boxes don't like that. But on some level, genre is a scholarly effort or sometimes a marketing effort. But there's a lot of blurred lines between genres. And so if somebody said that was a mystery, I would say, yeah, it's a mystery. If somebody said that's a horror movie, I'd say, yeah, it's a horror movie. If somebody said that's a psychological thriller, I'd say, yeah, it's a psychological thriller. It can be all those things.
I guess Silence of the Lambs would be very similar.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of that stuff was marketed as a thriller because that was kind of a point where horror was a little more of a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
Like late 90s, you start to get where horror is starting to come back, maybe because of Scream, I'm not sure. But like, I know in publishing, at least throughout the 90s, you could not sell a horror book. They had to relabel things as thrillers to get them to sell. It was kind of like where was I going with that? But it's on some level, it is semantics. But yeah, so I would consider both those thrillers. I would consider them mysteries. I would consider them horror movies.
Now, women have always been writing mystery, suspense, and thrillers. Of course, we have Sisters in Crime, which was created because they didn't think there was enough female representation as far as mysteries go. And I don't know this truth by the numbers, but from what I've seen, it looked like there seems to be a mass wave of more women writing thriller novels. Are you seeing the same as horror?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
But we've also always been, I think what's happening, I think women have always been writing this stuff. It's just a matter of whether there's been an opportunity for it to get in front of people. I mean, if you look at the origins of horror, you know, that's Mary Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
So we've always been there, but I think right now there are more opportunities than there were, say, in the 80s. And a lot of those opportunities then were kind of like, well, how much like a man can you write? Mm-hmm. As opposed to how much like how you want to write can you write? Whereas now I think we're seeing a broader range of style and content.
What about your style? How do I know I'm reading a Hailee Piper novel?
Oh, that's, I'm probably the worst person to ask that question. I do have my central tenets. Like it has to be empathetic and emotional. It has to be weird. It has to be queer. I had something else, but now I can't remember it. But I jump between subgenres. Like none of my books so far have been the same subgenre of horror. I've got possession horror, slasher, cosmic horror, body horror. This one I consider like horror and dark fantasy, crime horror, forgetting something, space horror. Yeah. So I kind of just got a reputation for just jumping around those things. But readers have told me that there's still the similar voice running between them, where being emotionally involved. And I think Laurel Hightower, she wrote the introduction to my short story collection, Unfortunate Elements of My Anatomy, was saying that she said, Haley Piper writes around corners. It was kind of just, I try to lead the reader in with something familiar. And then once I've got you, I can go off in whatever bizarre direction I please.
So aside from style, and you said that you write in multiple genres, other than the queer aspect, are there some common themes throughout your novels?
I think it depends. There's definitely identity aspects, although I still kind of bind that up in queer themes. I'm not sure. I think they tackle different themes. I don't like to repeat myself if I can help it. So even like my book, The Worminous Kings, is now getting sequels, and I try to kind of, challenge the first book a little bit with those sequels while also still continuing the story, because I don't want to just write the same thing again.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people really want to read the same thing again. I mean, some of them might, but that's not me.
Yeah, actually, I was interviewing somebody, was it last week? Readers tell you they want something different, but then when you change it, they get angry with you.
I know. And that's the curse of sequels, is just that everyone has their own expectations and you can't make everyone happy with, you have a better chance with a new book that has, that's a standalone of making people happy than with a sequel, because, a sequel, the readers own the first book a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So they've gotten attached to certain things. They've gotten their theories. They've got their feelings about some things. Then you come in with a second book and you wreck the hell out of all that. And it's like, it kind of feels unfair. So I can sympathize, but I also still need to continue telling the story. And I think that's the case with, most people writing sequels. It's like, well, they have more to say.
I want to talk about setting. Setting is important to many novels, classic novels, Dickens, a couple of my favorites, Wuthering Heights and The Grapes of Wrath. Setting was ultra important. But as a rule, it seems to me that mystery setting tends to be more important. I hate to say that, but I am. Tends to be more important than maybe other genres. However, horror to me seems probably even more so. Do you think that's fair?
I think it depends. Well, how would I? Yes, but with the caveat that I think you could move certain stories around to different settings, but once it's there, it has to plant its roots in. You need to feel like you're part of this. Otherwise, it's not going to be as horrifying. You're not going to feel the dread of it as much. And, horror has some such infamous settings. Like Hill House is a good example. Now I'm blanking on any others, of course. Miskatonic Institute or University, whatever it's called. You get this, but wherever it's set, you get dug into the layers of it. And a lot of times the setting itself has a character to it.
What's your favorite setting? Do you have one?
I do, but I'm blanking on the name of it. I cannot remember the name of the house in this book. Tell Me I'm Worthless by Alison Rumfitt. The house in that book is so evil and horrifying. Like that I had to put that book down a few times because that house is so hateful. It disturbed me. I'm sure there's a more fun setting, but that's the one that comes to mind as far as that it horrified me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you really had your work cut out for you when you decided to write No Gods for Drowning. I mean, you had to take the horror genre and you took mystery and fantasy. So with that, you had to do world building. Why would you do that to yourself?
I honestly, at one point, considered, is there a way to tell this in our world and just make my life slightly easier? Mm-hmm. Like, could I tell this in, like, I don't know, 30s New York or something? And the answer was no. There was just too much background with the gods and why they were important that I just was like, there's no way to set this in our world. So, and that's probably why it took so many years to develop in my brain before I finally started writing. And even then I changed a bunch of stuff. There's a point where some of it was different and I had written about 5 chapters and I was like, I don't want to do this. Yeah. So I changed it again. And I was just like, write just whatever you want, just whatever you want, write that. Don't worry about how you can sell it, how you can explain it. Just write it and you'll figure out how to explain it and build on it later. So I did. And yeah, it took a lot of revising, a lot of editing, a lot of rewriting to make it all feel cohesive. So I wouldn't recommend it for anyone to do that to themselves, but I'm glad I did. It is the book I wanted it to be.
And that's good. Have you ever made a decision in your writing based on maybe readers' reviews?
Not really. I don't know if that sounds good or bad.
And I'm not talking about writing to market, but maybe they said something you thought, I could have done that better.
The thing is, with there being such a delay between books, like by the time one book is getting reviews, you've already written the next book.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to, because a lot of times I'll see something and it's like, I already kind of learned that lesson with the next one before I got to see somebody after. I mean, I'm pretty set in my style and voice these days, though. So I feel like I learn more from editors, or I my main points of like, oh, I should have done that better is when an editor is pointing it out to me. There are times, I think the only thing would be that sometimes if something's been misunderstood, then there's definitely part of me that's like, I wish I could have gotten that across. But the unfortunate thing is communication is imperfect. There is no way you can get your thought across clearly to every single person who's going to hear it. And it's really more important that you stay authentic to how you communicate and how you can best accomplish the vision of the story or the idea of the story, and not worry about trying to get it to say the same thing to every person, even if some point is wildly misunderstood. Because you can't control how people are reading mm-hmm. books. Some people are reading a book in a corner, in a quiet room, with a cup of tea next to them. And other people are reading their book with the TV on and music playing while their kids are bothering them and they're trying to cook dinner all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have control over that. You have to release it to the reader, and whatever they say is their feelings about it. And that's theirs. They own that, and you own the book.
Yeah, I can't think of any books that way. I know with movies, there's movies that I watched in the theater. I thought, wow, that sucked. And then I watched it later and I'm like, it was hysterical, and vice versa. So so much of it can depend on where you are and what your mood is and that sort of thing. So it's a very good point to make.
And so I've done that where I've revisited things and changed my mind about them too. So yeah, totally.
Going back to setting, one of my favorite movies is Poltergeist, and I haven't watched it in quite a while because I'm afraid it won't stand up. I don't know.
You should go back to it. I love that movie still.
Well, let me tell you one thing I love about it and why I think it was popular, successful, and so frightening. And that is because it was white folks in the suburbs. Would you agree?
That was never the case for me. But that may be why it was popular. I mean, I grew up in the woods, so I couldn't really relate to the setting in that sense. But I also didn't not relate in the sense that I'm very easy with this stuff. Like, I pretty much just accept things when I see them on TV or a movie, unless they're like internally inconsistent. And that has probably led to romanticization of things that, like, I would always see movies set in New York City when I hadn't been to New York City. I'm like, New York City looks cool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been there now, so I know better. But, you know, just I'm sure on some level that was the case for a lot of people. That doesn't mean it was the case for everybody who enjoyed that movie. I think it's scary because, well, I'm not sure I really get scared by it, honestly. I enjoy the wonder of it. I like how the mom is so interested in the ghosts at first before mm-hmm. it becomes a problem. And I like the kind of interesting mythos it builds with the afterlife, as if it's the muscle of the world, and this physical world we live in is just the skin that's over it. There's a lot of wonder to that movie, just because it's like this, it's people talking about what they think happens after we die and how it might reach out for us. But I also watch movies very weirdly. Sometimes, like, I'll tell somebody, like, yeah, I saw Killer Clowns as being about this, or I saw Hellraiser as being about this. And they're just like, how would you ever get that perspective about this movie?
Yeah, to me, those are on two different planes. I'll tell you the scariest thing to me in Poltergeist, and I don't know why. I mean, the pool scene was scary. The tree grabbing the boy was scary. But the thing that scared me the most was the mother running down the hall, and the hall kept getting longer and longer. I think because I could see that happening in a nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. It is nightmare imagery.
Yeah, it that stuck with me for quite a while. And just a few seconds in the film. So I think there was so much that was beautifully done in that film, I have to say.
And that's a cool thing with horror, too, is like you just get that one moment and that movie sticks with somebody forever.
Yep, absolutely. Have you ever written any scenes that really disturbed you as you wrote them? And not necessarily that's a bad thing at all, but...
No, I think it's good. I think the more easily scared you are, the better you're going to be able to convey horror.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going back a bit. There was a scene in The Worm and His Kings when Monique, the main character, is going up. She's trying to get into this building because she thinks it can lead to where her missing girlfriend is. And she sees her reflection, but it's nighttime and the light is weird. And it looks to her like it's her, but dead. Like she is, like she can see herself moving. Like she can see her hand moving. She can see herself stepping side to side. It's her reflection, but just because of the way the light is cast, it looks like a corpse to her. It bugged me while I was writing it. There was one in Queen of Teeth. It didn't bug me till afterward, but it was a woman has essentially a bird skeleton drop out of her between her legs.
Oh.
And I wrote that not really thinking about it. And then I went back to revise it. And I just had this clutching in my gut.
Yeah.
Where I was like, why the hell did I write that?
Did it stay in?
Oh, yeah, it stayed in. I had to leave it into that.
I have a thriller novel that's sitting on the shelf these days, but I remember more than once, but one day in particular, I'm writing a scene and I feel myself sweating. My heart is racing. My palms are wet. And I'm like, this is going to be good, you know?
Yeah, that's good. That's a good sign.
It's a great feeling when that happens. Someday I'll get back to that. Maybe I'm worried I won't get that feeling back. I like PI novels. So that's, I think, why I got distracted.
I hear you.
So from your experience, what makes a horror success? And I know there could be a million reasons, but what makes one a success and one makes it flop?
If I knew that, I'd be making so much money giving advice about that stuff. I honestly don't know. There are books that do really well that I can't see the appeal. And there are books that I think are brilliant and they just don't pick up. They don't take off. Again, my feeling is that you have to write your art. You have to write authentically to you and then just kind of hope that people will latch on and they'll connect to it. I honestly have no idea. Like that is, I'm the worst. Either I'm the worst person to ask that question to, or nobody knows. Maybe I don't know. Cause I think if maybe publishers knew that, they would only pick up the books that fit that criteria.
Yeah, that is very true. We wish we knew that magic formula. An example, I told myself I wasn't going to bring up Stephen King during this conversation, but I'm going to bring up Stephen King because I don't get it. I've read The Shining, and the book is scarier than the movie, but either way, I don't get it. I find it boring, both the book and the movie. It is fucking scary because I've been terrified of clowns since I was a kid. He couldn't have done any better for me. But the book, like you said, sometimes you just like, why? why was that so popular? But a lot of people love it, so I can't down it. It just wasn't my thing.
Yeah. I mean, it is going to be so subjective as to what connects and what doesn't. Yeah, I've never read that book, so I can't get into my opinion because I don't have one. The movie, I liked the movie more when I was younger. I rewatched it a couple years ago, and it kind of wasn't working for me as much as it used to. But that's okay. Different things affect us at different times in our lives.
I know from somebody that talked to Stephen, he's never really happy with how his movies turn out because he just, like any author, he just lets them take over. But like one thing that happened in The Shining in the book, it was a very, very scary scene, was the topiary was coming after, which I can't remember which character. And it was terrifying.
Yeah, I remember that from the TV movie version.
The TV movie, they did that. They didn't do it in the movie version because they said it would look too ridiculous and it would look comical. I don't know. I don't know if I watched the TV version because I don't remember how well they did with that.
I think it was, I remember he was a little happier with it, with the TV version of The Shining, because it adhered to more like the scenes of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how well it did, because I didn't really watch it. I saw the trailer and it had the topiaries stalking Danny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew it was never, he was never happy with the original movie, which is funny because it was such a huge success.
I mean, he and Stanley Kubrick had very different philosophies as far as how storytelling works. I remember one anecdote where, I don't know if this is true, but this is what I heard, that Stanley Kubrick called Stephen King up one night during the production and asked, "Do you believe in God?" And Stephen King said, "Yes, I do." And Stanley Kubrick said, "I don't," and hung up the phone.
That's a great story. I hope that's true.
I think that if that's true, I think it says everything about why those are so different.
Yeah, I love that story. I hope it's true. And you know what? I'm going to make it true. It's true in my head. So I am brand new to the horror genre, and I'm heading to the store or to the library. What three books should I start with?
Oh, three. Oh, shoot.
If you want to give me one, that's fine.
Well, what I had prepared was something I feel bridges crime to horror.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Children of Chicago by Cynthia Pelayo. It's about a detective in Chicago who is kind of dealing with kids are murdering each other and trying to figure out what is going on. It seems simple at first, like, you know, kid's dead, this other kid did it, open and shut. But there seems to be some ritual being passed around the kids where they are calling on a figure called the Pied Piper to murder someone for them. But in return, they have to murder someone for him. And it's kind of being passed around both as like an urban legend, but also as like a going viral, I suppose, is a way of putting it internet wise. So just it's being passed from kid to kid as just like, oh, yeah, you know, such and such said this awful rumor about you. You can just call the Pied Piper and he'll kill them for you.
That sounds good.
It is a really good book. And it's so this detective is trying to investigate how true any of this is, but also is dealing with family stuff and how this might be linked to something that happened to her family in the past.
I'm taking note of that one. So before I let you go, I have to ask one question.
Sure.
I'm sending you to the library and I'm telling you that horror and nonfiction are off limits. What section are you going to go to?
Probably sci-fi and fantasy. See if there's something I want to pick up there, or maybe the graphic novel section, because they kind of just throw everything together so you can get whatever you want without breaking those rules.
Yeah, graphic novels are really getting popular. I need to go back to reading. I used to devour sci-fi. Once I found mystery, that's pretty much all I read. But I need to go back and check it out some more.
There's if you want to check out graphic novels and you want something mystery, that's kind of mystery, kind of horror. Have you heard of Fatale by Ed Brubaker?
No, but I'm going to write it down.
Okay, that's one you should
Fatale.
Check out.
Fatale. All right, good deal.
Yeah.
Well, remind everybody, this is Haley Piper that I've been speaking with. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been great.
Her upcoming novel is No Gods for Drowning. You can go and pre-order it right now, and you'll get it in less than a month. So go do that. Thank you again, Haley. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.